trying to track down outstanding people who had close connections of one kind or another with Mr. Hoover, we decided without any hesitation at all that one of the people we should have here on the platform would be a former FBI agent who has been one of the great fighters for freedom and America and all the principles in which we believe for many, many years. And in spite of his still youthful appearance, I can't tell you just how many years those are, but many of you know him for decades, I'm sure. He's done a wonderful job. He has had to curtail his activities to some extent, but he is still doing a wonderful job of research and guidance for those of us who are keenly disturbed. And I know how delighted you will be, as we were, when we first had word that we could count on having Dan Smoot with us tonight. Dan?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That's worth the trip up from Texas. In his eulogy on J. Edgar Hoover, President Nixon said the director personified integrity, honor, principle, courage, discipline, dedication, loyalty, and patriotism. Certainly all of this is true. What President Nixon did not say about Mr. Hoover was interesting. The president said nothing about J. Edgar Hoover as the foremost symbol of anti-communism. I think Mr. Hoover richly deserved the abundant praise he received from other sources for his adamant stand against communism. Yet, in my personal view, it was attitude and not really accomplishment that was worthy of praise. Communist influence and power have grown mightily in this country during the past 40 years, not measurably restrained by the work of Mr. Hoover and the FBI. Now, the FBI has discharged its statutory obligations with regard to communism magnificently. The FBI, I suspect, knows more about the official apparatus of the Communist Party in the United States than the Communist Party officials themselves know. But that is relatively unimportant, because the real work of communism is not done by the shabby crowd who constitute the membership and known officialdom of the Communist Party. Communism is being foisted upon us dishonestly by our own elected officials and their appointed bureaucrats and judges, and by such tax-exempt organizations as the Council on Foreign Relations, the National Council of Churches, the National Education Association, the big monopolistic unions, the multi-billion-dollar foundations, and so on. None of these is communistic or subversive by statutory definition. Most of them claim to be anti-communist, hence all of them are beyond the purview of FBI jurisdiction. If the FBI arrested every card-carrying communist in the United States, and it could, and if the courts could somehow be induced to permit prosecution and imprisonment of all of them, the communist movement would not thereby be perceptibly handicapped, as long as we have such men as McGovern and Humphrey and Muskie and Nelson and Mondale and Kennedy and Javits in the Senate and Nixon in the White House. The real job of fighting communism in the United States is a monumental two-step effort involving, first, educating the people to understand what communism really is, even when it is being espoused under false labels by our most powerful and esteemed non-communist political and intellectual leaders. And in the second place, follow up political action to sweep from public life all of those powerful communist supporters and to replace them with constitutionalists who will restore our constitutional republic. Now, the FBI does not have jurisdiction, in fact, is prohibited by statute and by Department of Justice regulations from engaging in this real educational political fight against communism. For years I had hopes that Mr. Hoover, before he went home to the Lord, would do what Major General Lavelle recently did in Vietnam. That is, sacrifice his own career in order to do what should be done for the safety and best interest of his country. In Mr. Hoover's case, that would have meant ignoring Department of Justice restrictions and speaking out to tell the American people the whole truth about who really is promoting communism in this country. At one moment, I had high hopes. On the occasion when Mr. Hoover called Martin Luther King the biggest liar in the country, I rejoiced to hear that truth and expected Mr. Hoover to go on and tell it all, namely that it was King, that King was not only an unsavory character in his personal life, but was also a dedicated, disciplined member of the communist conspiracy, whose essential role was to create, under the guise of peaceful demonstrations, the racial discord and violence and bitter divisions that came very close to creating complete anarchy in our country. When Mr. Hoover refrained from making that exposure, I concluded that he was much wiser than I. He felt he had better not kick over the traces of established discipline while in office, and thus risk discrediting his immeasurably important reputation. Then I had another hope for Mr. Hoover, the hope that he would resign and write a book before it was too late. Not another book like Masters of Deceit, but a book that Mr. Hoover could have written, naming the people and organizations really responsible for giving communism a vice-like grip on the jugular vein of this great nation. But he stayed in office until our Lord ended all of his aches and ecstasies, and the book was never written. But in the legend and the reality of what Mr. Hoover really was and what he did, there is a lesson that could be more important to our country than the exposure which he could have made, but never did. A lesson about power. Back in the 1930s, before Congress passed the Lindbergh Law establishing federal jurisdiction in kidnapping cases, the gang of Alvin Karpis and Basil Banghart was caught by state authorities, tried and convicted in state court on charges of kidnapping, and sentenced to long prison terms in the Illinois State Prison of Joliet. In 1942, Karpis, Banghart, and several of their gang members broke out of Joliet. The FBI found them in Chicago, and after a shootout, arrested all of them. It was a brilliantly conceived and executed FBI operation. No loss of life except that of one gang member named O'Connor, who was killed by FBI men during the gunfight. But after it was all over, the question did arise, what jurisdiction did the FBI have? They were prisoners of the state of Illinois, serving time for violating state law. They escaped from a state prison. They hadn't even crossed a state line. What federal law had they violated? Mr. Hoover answered the question. He said they violated the Selective Service Act because when they left Joliet, they failed to notify a draft board of their forwarding address. That bit of wry humor has evoked many a good laugh, but the humor loses a little of its titillating quality when removed from its special context and pondered objectively. In its special context, it is good. A swaggering gang of dangerous thugs had been removed as a threat to society, and government's jurisdiction for the surgery rested on a technicality that makes a good yarn to enliven an after-dinner speech. But in another context, it might be grim instead of funny. If law can be stretched to ensnare Karpis and Banghart, and more importantly, if the power to stretch the law or not to stretch it is in the hands of someone not thoroughly devoted, as J. Edgar Hoover was, to high ideals of justice, fairness, and respect for constitutional limitations, who might become the victim of some future stretching. Larry Bunker, Cleon Skousen, Bob Welch, Clyde Watts. There was a strong drive in Congress during the late 1930s to convert the FBI into a national police force and to give J. Edgar Hoover almost dictatorial power over law enforcement in the United States. The one man who scotched that drive was J. Edgar Hoover himself. In thus rejecting power, Hoover not only behaved in a way absolutely unique in the annals of bureaucracy, but he also made the single greatest contribution to the cause of liberty and constitutional government that any civil servant of government has made in the 20th century. Congress did not succeed in making Hoover head commissar of a national police force. But through the years, it did heap upon Mr. Hoover's FBI enormous investigative power. More power than should be reposed in any federal police agency, and much of it based on laws that are wholly unconstitutional. Most of us felt reasonably safe when that power was in J. Edgar Hoover's hands, because we did not feel that he would ever use it against the best interests of our country. I knew he wouldn't. But Mr. Hoover's gone now, and that the power that was given to him is in other hands. I know little about the present acting director. He may be a splendid person. Certainly, I have no reason to say that he is not. But that's not the point. And it wasn't really the point when Mr. Hoover was alive either. The point is that we too easily forget the warning of Thomas Jefferson. In questions of power, speak to me not of confidence in men, but bind them down from mischief with the chains of a constitution. We don't seem to mind when large aggregations of illegitimate power are placed in the hands of a good man whom we can trust. And we forget that sooner or later, that same power will pass into other hands. In recent years, there has been a steady barrage of bitter attacks on Mr. Hoover and the FBI from the communist radical left, demanding that the FBI stripped of many of its powers. We here in this room have been in the forefront of the fight against those attacks, defending Mr. Hoover and the FBI. It was proper that we do so, because Mr. Hoover was our foremost symbol of anti-communism. It was not the FBI's illegitimate power, such as was conferred upon it by the Civil Rights Act of 1964, for example, that the communist radical left wanted to remove. They wanted to remove Mr. Hoover and the FBI's power and authority to investigate and expose communism. Now, for 40 years, as I indicated, FBI exposure of communist activities did not do a great deal of harm to the real communist movement in this country. One reason was that the highest authorities in the conspiracy were careful to keep separated the routine chores of the official apparatus which the FBI could expose, and the important work of the respected non-communist communists whom the FBI had no authority to expose. But in recent years, that line of separation between avowed card-carrying communists and non-communist communists has become somewhat indistinct. Now, senators of the United States speak openly to crowds that are waving communist flags, calling for anarchy in the streets, shouting denunciations of the United States, and demanding a communist victory over our armed forces. It is becoming increasingly difficult to distinguish between a communist rally and a political convention. We have reached the point where exposure of communism, if it is to have any public credibility at all, must involve exposing activities of many of the most powerful political figures in the land. J. Edgar Hoover's reputation for integrity and patriotism was so great that many radical leftists feared that he might lose his temper and just start doing that any day. Now that Mr. Hoover is gone, the radical leftists have little worry on that score. The people who most urgently need to be investigated and exposed for their contributions to the cause of international communism are in positions of such power to see that the FBI is controlled. I guess that the radical communist left will now mute or abandon its campaign to curtail the power of the FBI. But I confess to you, if it does not, I, for one, am not going to have very much to say on the subject anymore. The question of who is subversive is now a matter of semantics and definition. And the people in position to make the critical definition are, of course, in government. If by subversive you mean someone who wants to restore constitutional government in the United States, and to that end, wants by legal means to undermine the power of the socialist communist cabal now in control, then you're pointing the finger straight at me. The Attorney General's list of subversive organizations could change, you know. Instead of containing the name of the Communist Party and of known communist fronts, that Attorney General's list could contain such names as the New England Rally for God, Family, and Country, the John Birch Society, and all other known patriotic groups. With J. Edgar Hoover gone, we cannot afford total complacency in the knowledge that the FBI investigates subversive activities. And I, for one, won't be as indignant as I have been in the past if the radical communist left renews its howls to curtail the power of the FBI. We should look upon the FBI as upon any other federal agency. If it seeks or gets without seeking power that cannot be traced to some specific grant of authority in our Constitution, we should oppose it, just as we oppose the illegal empire building of all other agencies of government. If it discharges its duties faithfully, fairly, impartially, regardless of race, creed, or color, or political party, within the bounds of statutes that are clearly constitutional, then we should thank God for saving us from our own folly. Our folly of applauding too easily while an agency of government acquired more power than it ought to have, merely because we had implicit trust in the man who then directed that agency. I, for one, shall try in all matters in the future to remember, as I hope you will, the warning of Thomas Jefferson. In questions of power, speak to me not of confidence in men, but bind them down from mischief with the chains of the Constitution. God bless you.